Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The lover is ever drunk with love. She is free. He is mad. She sings with delight as he dances in ecstasy.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We begin with the 13th century Persian poet Jalaluddin Rumi. He wrote thousands of these mystical odes and quatrains. He also founded the Sufi order, commonly known as the Whirling Dervishes, and his influence has spread into the music world, especially in the last quarter century. In fact, UNESCO has named 2007 the International Year of Rumi in honor of the 800th anniversary of his birth. And to give us some perspective on Rumi's enduring legacy, we're joined now by Sharam Shiva, author of the new book, Rending the Veil, Literal and Poetic Translations of Rumi, and the man behind this CD called Love Drunk. Sharam, welcome.
John, it's great to be here.
This CD of yours is just one of literally hundreds and hundreds of musical settings of the poetry of Rumi. Why are so many musicians in the late 20th, early 21st century drawn to this 13th century poet?
It's a very good point, John. If you go to Amazon and do a search on Rumi, you'll come up with probably over 300 different references. That's books, DVDs, and CDs combined. And Rumi is magic. You know, Rumi is right up there with some of the biggest Western talents, such as Beethoven, Mozart, of course, Shakespeare. And I always said that he is almost a combination of these few Western giants. He's a combination of Dante, Shakespeare, Galileo, you know, because he has all these different elements, and he inspires people.
So you mean it's not just poetry?
Not just poetry. He was very exceptional human being, and one of history's very colorful and unique characters. And his life story is not really known, because for the most part, his family, who are in Turkey, have tried to put out a very pristine image, which is always, as you know, the case with history. They try to make everything look as perfect.
So his family still is, I mean, there's like an unbroken line of people in Turkey who are descendants of this Persian poet.
That is correct. Yeah.
Now, he has become, against all odds, one of the most widely read poets in modern America. How did that happen?
In order for us to understand this correctly, we need to go back about maybe 80 years or so.
Can we do this quickly?
Yes. More so to 1940s when Omar Khayyam poetry became really hot.
Right, the Rubaiyat of
Omar Khayyam. And why did Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam become hot? It was because a poet named Fitzgerald did renditions of Omar Khayyam. And it was as if Omar Khayyam for the first time was speaking in English. Mm. And that is the magic of translation. When you can translate something where it sounds like it's written by the native speaker, then it can come across cultures. So when that happened, which happened in 1970s, and I have actually myself been translating Rumi since 1988, when, in a sense, the public grasped hold of these amazing poems written in a way that they can connect to and understand in modern free verse English.
So the language is no longer a difficulty, but we have the fact that this is, you know, a Muslim poet from the Near East, very troublesome part of the world yet again.
That's very true.
We have this, you know, kind of suspicion of all things Middle Eastern and Islamic, you know, in many parts of Western society. Is there something at play in current events that also, you know, sends people to Omar Khayyam or to Rumi or to any other port of entry to understanding that culture?
Yeah, I think it's all part of the mix. But if you know, because I know you, Noka, I've been on your show before, almost like 10 years ago.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, Rumi has been popular for a long time. This was before the crisis in Mid East. Mm-hmm. But I think the Mid East crisis have also helped for people try to grasp hold and try to understand this culture that the West is entangled with better. And Rumi is a perfect example of that.
Well, he was always, I mean, this is the International Year of Rumi, according to UNESCO, but he was an international guy from the get-go.
He was.
We refer to him as Persian. You've already mentioned his family still lives in Turkey. He was centered in the town of Konya for many years, but he was born in a town that is now in Afghanistan.
Three countries claim him as their national poet, Afghanistan, Iran, and Turkey. And none of these countries existed while Rumi was was around.
So, as you say, you know, it's one of the benefits of having great translations that it allows poetry to move from its original culture to other ones. Does music help? Sending it to music?
Yes, yes. The music, I think, is the most essential part of it. I'm glad that you brought the segue into music. Rumi, poetry of Rumi could not have happened without music and without rhythm. He wasn't a poet who would sit down and write beautiful words on paper. He was a poet where he would simply be speaking poetry, expressing himself through his words as he was feeling them, while he was pacing, while he was moving, while he was whirling, while he was basically dancing to rhythm of music. He had musicians almost with him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is always very much rhythm in Rumi poetry. And I think Rumi poetry, without music, although it works, is not 100%.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Rumi's poetry with music. And this features the great Persian singer Shahram Nazeri. در طلب گوهر دریای عشق موج زند موج چو دریا دلم موج زند موج That is the poetry of the 13th century mystic Jalaluddin Rumi, sung by Shahram Nazeri, great Iranian singer in the Persian classical tradition. My guest here on Soundcheck is Shahram Shiva. His book is called Rending the Veil, Literal and Poetic Translations of Rumi, and his CD Love Drunk is one of many musical responses to Rumi's poetry in recent years. What were Rumi's poems about?
Rumi, because he was so prolific, in a period of about maybe 25 years, he recited or perhaps composed about 70,000 verses of poetry. So in essence, he's covered every imaginable, conceivable topic. However, for the most part, especially once the things that do get translated into the English language have been the what we call the divine love poems, or basically just love poems. And they are, some of them are quite passionate, some of them are intimate. He has a few that border on
the erotic.
Mm-hmm. And of course, because, again, he has so many other topics, he has had philosophical poems and some that are anti-big religion, you know, anti-established religion and so forth.
Well, now he was, as I understand it, although he founded what we now know as the Mevlana or the Whirling Dervishes, there were Sufi orders and dervishes before Rumi, and he was brought up in a family that was, like, his father was a Sufi master or something like that?
Yeah, this is very true. You know, Sufism is basically means a mystic of Islam, and Islam is about 1,400 years old. However, spirituality goes back in that region for, you know, 5,000 years or beyond, and that's the distinction that I have taught to make between a dervish and a Sufi. A dervish is the mystic of the Middle East, where Sufis is specifically a Muslim mystic.
So the dervish is going back to kind of Zoroastrianism,
exactly,
and
right,
all that kind of
stuff.
Wow.
So Rumi, up until he was 38 and 39, he was brought up in this tradition, as you're mentioning, very strict, you know, no music, no poetry. We wouldn't even look at...
Because music in Orthodox Islam, it inflames the base emotions.
Even today.
Yeah.
Even there are countries in the Middle East where it's not played.
Yeah.
So up until he was 38 and 39, really, like, you know, just about he was 40. And then the legend has it that walks into his life, this almost Rasputin type of personality, this wild dervish, you know, called Shams, which means the sun, and transforms him. And in Rumi's own words, from a bookish, sober scholar to an impassioned lover of the divine and all things mystical.
Well, and of course, there's been much speculation on whether their love was just a divine love or a physical one as well between these two gentlemen. I guess Shams was older than Rumi.
Yeah, Shams was in his 60s.
Now, you actually allude to Shams. I mean, the poetry alludes to it, and therefore you do too in your setting of this poem, I Saw Goodness Getting Drunk. Let's hear a little bit of my guest Sharam Shiva and his recitation of some of Rumi's poetry.
Last night, I saw goodness getting drunk. He growled and said, I am a nuisance, but 100 souls cried out, we are yours, we are yours, we are yours. You are the light that spoke to Moses and said, said, Shams, who are you? He said, I am you. I am you. I am you. Last night.
Sharam Shiva is my guest. This is from his CD, Love Drunk, which is kind of a musical companion to his book, Rending the Veil, Literal and Poetic Translations of Rumi. 2007 is, according to UNESCO, the International Year of Rumi. So there's a lot of drunkenness, a lot of wine, a lot of references to drinking in Rumi's poetry. What is all that about?
Isn't that odd? I mean, for a region that, is so dry, basically. This is not just Rumi. It's Persian classical poetry, which went on for 400 years. There are hundreds of thousands of verses all dedicated to this, partly because it is part of the culture of the Persian classical poetry to weave these metaphors, such as a beloved, which is a beautiful girl next to you, and wine, as you know. So it's like a setting where you're having a really good time. That's what they use. But people like Rumi take advantage of that. And it's very important for people to understand something that's going on here is that Rumi was a pop star. These poems were the most popular thing you could possibly do. So
were they sung in his lifetime?
I'm not sure if they were sung, but they were recited. His style, while he was alive, was being copied almost 1,000 miles away in India.
Wow.
Because he was doing something that hadn't been done before. And, of course, this is a long time ago, so he was kind of setting a trend. He was being very free, and he was quoting the Old Testament. You know, he was quoting Jesus, he was quoting Moses, he was quoting Joseph, all these characters, which before, basically, if you read the history of poetry from that area, it's all about, you know, I love my camel, and I'm riding through the hills with my gun, or bow and arrow, and things like that, and shooting a deer. That's basically
But when he's writing about being drunk with love, he's not talking about literal drunkenness. He's using it, you said metaphor. It's a metaphor
right.
For what?
So in case of Rumi, since we are here talking about Rumi, now we have had great many Persian poets, and some of them were drunks. So let me just clarify that.
Okay.
But when it came to Rumi, he wasn't. But he uses that as being almost intoxicated on love, being taken away by this sense, or being overwhelmed by the presence of the divine, which is actually a metaphor used in Christianity often.
So it's the sense of the state of ecstasy, basically.
That is correct, yes.
All right. Now, another metaphor that is used in a lot of Rumi's poetry is marriage, which doesn't necessarily mean the union, excuse me, of a man and a woman. I mean, I guess the current administration would be not too taken with that idea, but, you know, 800 years ago, he was proposing marriage as a more of a spiritual thing.
Yeah, they call it basically a union, or they call it also wedding night. It's actually part of the culture. It happens today that when a someone of that stature passes away, they say that the night of his passing is his wedding night. It's basically just used as another, you just said it, John, it's a metaphor for union.
And this is actually, this is a Western classical composer, the American composer Eric Whitaker, and a setting of the Rumi poem called This Marriage. Music here from the American composer Eric Whitaker, very popular composer of choral music, and here a choral setting of This Marriage, poetry by Jalaluddin Rumi. My guest is Sharam Shiva, who's written several books of translations of the poetry of Rumi, including the most recent one called Hush, Don't Say Anything to God, and the book I mentioned earlier, Rending the Veil, literal and poetic translations of Rumi. I suppose, Sharam, it's a big idea that we're talking about. It's one guy, but it's a big idea. Is there something in the way he lived his life, something in the way he approached God and love and big ideas that makes him resonant today, 800 years later?
Yeah, and I think this is perhaps the primary reason for his popularity in the West, was because Rumi was all-inclusive. He loved humanity, and he made a point of showing it, and he made a point of loving and welcoming all religions. And both men and women. And these are radical ideas, even today in Islam. And that's why he was quoting so much from the Old Testament, New Testament, and he was weaving all these elements just to prove his point.
Well, the inclusive nature of Rumi's poetry is nowhere more evident than in the fact that it has now been translated into languages of virtually every inhabited part of the world. One of the most widely read poets these days here in the States. And this is the International Year of Rumi. We've been speaking with the author Sharam Shiva. You can get details of Sharam's various musical and literary endeavors on the new soundcheck page of our website at wnyc.org or at Sharam's own website, which is rumi.net. Sharam, great to see you again. Thanks
it's
for being
with
us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
Ishq aa